Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host for today, Kyle Scheidler, the director of the Threat Information Office at the Center for Security Policy. I'm filling in for your host, Frank Gaffney. Joining me is Diana West. She's a nationally syndicated columnist. She blogs at dianawest.net, and she's the author of American Betrayal, and really sort of an expert in all things Russian collusion. Diana, thanks for joining us.
Oh, wonderful to be with you, Kyle.
So I wanted to talk to you about a recent comment that President Vladimir Putin made about the Russian nuclear deterrent and their new hypersonic and high maneuverable warheads. This is something that obviously we've been very worried about at the Center for Security Policy because of its implications for missile defense. But this is a technology that the Russians acquired through a bit of subterfuge, and it's an interesting case. And I thought it would be nice if you could walk us through how it was that the Russians came upon this.
Yes, well, I would begin by saying I'm not sure it qualifies as subterfuge. It came to them as part of the Russian Reset program that President Obama and then Secretary of State Clinton made so much of, were so deeply involved in, and indeed the Clinton Foundation was a direct beneficiary of this effort to essentially recreate Silicon Valley outside of Moscow, and a very high number, a very high proportion of the tech giants that indeed became part of this Skolkovo project outside of Moscow under the Russian Reset were also contributors to the Clinton Foundation. So we do see the tie-in. Where we get to the subterfuge, I suppose, is where this was not never envisioned as a military project for the Russians. It was supposed to modernize their technology research and development. However, we do have from the Army, going back to 2012, published in 2013, a report calling attention to the fact that at Skolkovo, we are seeing research and development of hypersonic cruise missile technology. And this is something that Peter Schweizer first brought to light, I think it would be in terms of the public, in 2016. However, the Army report, also public certainly for policymakers, this was designed actually to assess the policy implications of the Skolkovo development, going back to 2013, was certainly available. Nothing was done. Nothing was done later. And what amazes me at this moment is that there seems to be no understanding that when Vladimir Putin now can proudly point to his hypersonic cruise missiles, no one is also pointing another finger back at Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama for effectively having delivered this technology to them.
I mean, you describe this as part of the Russian reset, as I guess the open explanation by the Obama administration and the Secretary of State, the Clinton State Department. I mean, it seems on its face that any of our listeners just relying on their common sense and sort of, you know, basic knowledge of history would have said, hey, guys, don't you think the Russians are going to use this for military purposes? I mean, I guess this is the refrain of 8 years of the Obama administration, but what were they thinking?
Well, Kyle, that's a very good question. And I think to really put it into context, let's go back to the 1990s when we had Red China backing President Clinton, certainly in both his election in 1992 via the Riotti family, if you remember that whole illegal campaign finance story, and then certainly much more well-known in 1996 with the re-election campaign, where we watched the export under President Clinton of high technology to China that ended up modernizing Beijing's entire military complex to a point of becoming a first-class military power. in exchange for campaign contributions. Now, we have to understand that this is a parallel operation when we go to the Obama years and see money coming into the Clinton Foundation, a much more sophisticated operation than the Committee to Reelect the President back in 1996. But we have to understand this is a pattern with this family, with this party. We have to understand that this is nothing new. It is not an outlier. It is not a one-off. This is what they do. And it actually, in thinking about it and having my blood boil over again, you know, over these many years, I was thinking Bill Clinton is really the father of the Chinese MERV, and Hillary Clinton may well be the mother of the Russian hypersonic cruise missile. This is a national security scandal that is just in plain sight, and yet, well, you and I are talking about it, but in terms of our country actually understanding and acknowledging and really coming to terms with it, there's nothing on the table. As we absolutely, you know, continue to hyperventilate in the public square about Trump, Russia, collusion, phone calls, back channels, what have you. But we're actually looking at the modernization of our dire foes' military complexes, and nobody really cares. So, wow, what do we do with this?
I think that's a really good point, Diane. I mean, we have a sense of what it looks like when foreign powers actually meddle in an American election and the dire consequences that you get from such meddling. And then you compare and contrast that with the just sort of bizarre situation with Trump and Russia, where, you know, a president that has taken a hard line on the Russians in Syria and elsewhere is being accused of just the most grotesque collusion despite the absence of all evidence. And I think what's partially interesting about that is the response of our intelligence community. I mean, you made a good point in an article you wrote talking about Operation Ghost Stories, which was that case where the FBI rounded up 10 Russian illegals. I mean, this was a real spy network, long-placed, well-trained operatives, and they rounded them all up in part because they were getting close to Secretary Hillary Clinton. And yet now you have this case where they're alleging, you know, major collusion with the Trump administration. They're getting close to Trump with these aides, but they didn't do anything. They just watched. How do you compare these two?
Well, I think that if we understand that national security is actually not of paramount interest in either of these cases, we can start to understand them as political war. And I think it's really important to remember that even as we've talked about the hypersonic transfer to Russia, remember when candidate Trump was on the trail talking very specifically about his plans to modernize and expand America's nuclear arsenal, whereas candidate Clinton, Hillary Clinton, was talking about really essentially continuing the Obama military decline program, specifically saying things like she couldn't think of one good reason for a next generation of American cruise missiles, for example. So if you're sitting there in the Kremlin, what president would you prefer to see take power? The person who's going to continue the military decline, or the outlier, the extremely unusual, unexpected, unpredictable Donald Trump, who is talking about modernizing and expanding America's nuclear arsenal? I mean, I think that we are very much manipulated into this whole concept of Putin hoping to create a Trump presidency when he's been doing so well with Obama Clinton. So that is sort of the basis of kind of a new way to look at this. And then in terms of the examples you mentioned, Robert Mueller is the common denominator here. And when he was FBI director, he didn't come to the American people and talk about Russian influence on the political process, on the Obama administration, directly concerning this idea of this deeply embedded, highly trained, operational Russian network getting close to Secretary of State Clinton. No, he presided over their instant deportation back to Russia without the normal debriefing, attempts to turn the agents, even getting a particularly good trade in terms of an exchange. Whereas today, what is he doing? He's indicting 13 Russians for trolling, so-called, back in Russia with no hopes of prosecution in an effort to tarnish the Trump administration. A political maneuver, just as before he was politically maneuvering not to tarnish the Obama-Clinton administration. And again, the takeaway there is there's no national security interest being protected or advanced.
Well said, Diana. Unfortunately, we have to leave it there. It's always a pleasure to talk to you on this and many other topics. But we will be right back on Secure Freedom Radio. Joining us will be Fred Flights.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host, Kyle Scheidler, filling in for the great Frank Gaffney, who is off today. Joining me now, he's a favorite of Secure Freedom Radio listeners everywhere, Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs at the Center for Security Policy, former CIA analyst and former Chief of Staff for Ambassador John Bolton at the U.S. State Department. He is my colleague and friend, Fred Flights. Fred, welcome back.
Hey, Kyle, great to be here.
Fred, you're really a guy we turn to for all things non-proliferation. So I wanted to get your take on this recent announcement that the North Koreans are considering coming back to the table with the U.S. to discuss their nuclear program. What's the deal?
Well, it was a stunning development. North Korea agreed to a summit in late April with South Korean President Moon, and reportedly is willing to discuss giving up its nuclear weapons program and normalizing relations with the United States. I mean, many of us are extremely skeptical about this, and I think we have to talk about what this would mean. It is a stunning departure from what the North would agree to, even as early as this year, and it is an offer that the North repeatedly refused to make to the Obama administration, even though it was prepared to give away the store to get a nuclear deal with North Korea. There's definitely something going on here, and I can simply say without a shadow of a doubt, regardless of how sincere North Korea is, it clearly has made this strategic move because of the policies of President Trump.
We're talking with Fred Flights of the Center for Security Policy and former CIA analyst about North Korea's recent nuclear negotiations offer. And I really want to get your thoughts both on the impact of sort of Trump-North Korea diplomacy and what role that it played in this recent offer. You said that this is something that we can really thank President Trump for, bringing them back to the table. How did he do it?
Well, I mean, there's no question that the president's policies are responsible, and even some people on the left are admitting that. South Korean President Moon has said that it is President Donald Trump's policies got North Korea to the negotiating table. There's a major South Korean newspaper that has said, you know, with talk in Washington of a bloody nose preemptive strike against North Korea, the North Koreans changed their tactics. So I think the North Koreans see a decisive president for which force really is on the table, who is thinking of using military force if they continue to test nuclear weapons. We see sanctions that are much tougher. We know there's cheating, but in the past, the Obama administration didn't bother to make other states enforce them. We know China and Russia are cheating, but we also know China is substantially complying with these sanctions. And also, there's another aspect that people aren't talking about. The Chinese are worried. Two Chinese academics were allowed to publicly discuss last year that North Korea has become a latent enemy of China and that North Korea has become a drag on its national security and that China has to worry that North Korea's nuclear test could leak radiation into China. They actually publicly discussed that the Chinese government should start talking about a contingency plan to replace the Kim regime if it loses a war with the U.S. Kyle, this is unprecedented that this is ever being discussed in China. This stuff is always censored. I'm not saying I trust the North Koreans or the Chinese, but I will say that the whole equation was changed by Donald Trump's principled leadership on this issue.
That's pretty remarkable, Fred, and obviously something those of us in the national security space who thought that Trump could be a different sort of president are glad to see. But this is, you know, negotiations with the North Koreans is a place where many administrations have stumbled in the past. What are some of the traps that the Trump administration should be looking out for if they do decide to go to the table with the North Koreans?
Well, in all likelihood, the North Koreans are playing a game they played before. They want to split the U.S. from other nations. They want to extract concessions, and they want to buy time without agreeing and without agreeing to give up anything or abide by their commitments. I think it's crucial that we not play that game, that we say to the North Koreans, okay, prove to us you're serious. We need very intrusive inspections. We need a complete declaration of North Korea's nuclear program, and all of its nuclear sites have to be shut down. You know, the Bush administration in its second term tried this, and the North Koreans gave a declaration of its nuclear program. That was a fraud, and we rewarded them anyway. We took them off the state-sponsored terror list. This was under Condoleezza Rice, I might add. We took them off the state-sponsored terror list after they provided a fraudulent and incomplete list of its nuclear program. We can't play those games. If the North Koreans say they're serious, they're going to have to prove it.
Should we link, Fred Flight's North Korean behavior on other issues to negotiations as well? I mean, you mentioned, for example, the state sponsor of terrorism list, and the Trump administration put them back on that list in part because of their behavior. But is this something where, you know, really all aspects of the North Korean regime should be on the table, or should we try to keep it just to the nuclear issue?
No, all aspects have to be on the table. They have to stop counterfeiting. They have to stop using the diplomatic pouches for illegal activities, probably transporting drugs. The dear leader's half-brother was assassinated with chemical weapons in the Malaysia airport a few months ago. You know, prior administrations would just look the other way towards this kind of stuff. We can't do that anymore. This is a criminal regime. Everything's on the table. Or not only will there be no deal, we will continue to ratchet up the pressure.
One of the things you mentioned, Fred, and I think it's important, is the relationship with the South Koreans. Their new president is someone that really came into the office with a promise of sitting down with the North Koreans and holding hands and reestablishing a positive relationship. How do we keep them on board, but also keep a tough and unified alliance during these negotiations?
So far, I think that's going fairly well. You know, President Moon said if he was elected, he would first meet with Kim Jong-un. But Kim behaved so badly and tested so many missiles. I mean, meet with Kim before meeting President Trump. Moon met with Trump first. And I'm encouraged that Moon has said he's not going to let up sanctions. And this upcoming summit in late April will be in Panmunjom, the truth village, not in Pyongyang. That's important because the North Koreans wanted the propaganda value of the South Korean president coming to their capital. Moon wouldn't give it to them until he's sure that they are sincere in the negotiations. We need to keep an eye on Moon, but what I've seen so far is encouraging.
Well, that's very positive. And then what about the other parties to the talk? I mean, should this just be the United States and North Korea mano a mano, or who else should be at the table? Who do we need at the table to keep the North Koreans straight, and who would be, you know, who should we keep away from the table, I think, perhaps more importantly?
Well, I'd love to keep the Russians away from the table and include the Japanese and the Chinese, but I don't think that's possible. First of all, we don't want the Europeans in. They want to get involved in everything. They have been left out. Let's keep them out. But we need China there. We need to keep China on board. China wants to participate in multilateral talks. And if Russia has to be there, we have to be tough with Russia, because Russia is trying to fill the gap caused by increased Chinese enforcement of sanctions. And I mean, this is just Vladimir Putin causing more trouble wherever he can for the United States. So I think all these states will probably be involved in multilateral talks eventually.
Fred Flights, Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs at the Center for Security Policy, former CIA analyst and former Chief of Staff for Ambassador John Bolton at the U.S. State Department. Extremely enlightening, and that's why we are so glad to have you here at Secure Freedom Radio, and I'm sure we will have you back to keep us updated on this important situation.
with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host, Kyle Scheidler, filling in for the great Frank Gaffney, who is off tonight. Joining me now, he's Michael Cutler. He's a former Immigration and Naturalization Service agent, law enforcement federal agent. He knows a great deal about immigration policy and especially internal enforcement of that policy. And there's really no better time to speak to him than right now, with everything going on in the news that's immigration-related. Mike, thank you for joining us.
Kyle, it's great, as always, to join you. My regards to Frank when you speak with him.
I'll certainly pass those on. So, Mike, let's talk a little bit about the tit-for-tat between Attorney General Jeff Sessions and the mayor of Oakland and now also the governor of California. Attorney General Sessions went out to Sacramento and really gave it to them for their sanctuary city policies. Talk to us a little bit about how that started and where it stands now.
Well, you know, they really shouldn't be calling sanctuary cities sanctuary cities. I thought we should maybe call them magnet cities because of who they attract. You know, people that sneak into the country or violate our immigration laws pose a clear and present immediate danger to national security and public safety. And you may as well throw in the damage it does to work opportunities for Americans and wages for Americans and lawful immigrants. We have the most robust, welcoming immigration system in the world, legal immigration system. We admit 1 million lawful immigrants every year, tens of millions of temporary visitors, non-immigrants. So the idea that people who are now here illegally are going to obviously go to the cities and states where they're promised to be shielded from immigration law enforcement. And by the way, you know, the 9/11 commission to which I provided testimony made it clear, first and foremost, that the root cause of 9/11 and other terrorist attacks was the ability of terrorists to either enter the country with altered visas, phony names, run the borders, all of those elements of the immigration system with the key vulnerabilities that the terrorists exploited. And we've seen it in the years since 9/11 as well. So the idea that a mayor or a governor is going to undermine national security for a political agenda, and this isn't a left-right issue, by the way. This is a right-wrong issue. Full disclosure, I'm registered as a Democrat. Sanctuary cities are anti-labor as much as they're anti-security. So you have these cities coming up and saying, well, we're not going to work with immigration. So the problem we now have with transnational gangs, the continuing threat of international terrorists, and the federal government for years has done little to push back against sanctuary cities. Along comes Donald Trump, who made immigration his key issue, as well it should, because immigration impacts just about every challenge and threat that America and Americans face. And now the sanctuary cities are rising up and saying, not so fast, we're not going to let you do your job. Well, you know, when you take an oath of office, it's not a menu. You don't get to pick and choose what sections of law you like. You either sign on for the whole slate, the whole menu, if you will, or maybe you need to find different employment. And now you have the mayor of Oakland endangering the lives of the agents who are going out there to arrest very dangerous people by tipping them off that ICE is coming. At the very least, these people would flee, but some of them might have decided to fight, you know, the fight-flight decision. So that puts everybody at risk. It puts the community at risk. And the most likely victims of the crimes perpetrated by transnational criminals are, in point of fact, the members of the ethnic immigrant communities. They're not just from Latin America. This has never really been about Latinos. That's a false narrative created by the open borders immigration anarchists. Our immigration laws make absolutely no distinction about race, religion, or ethnicity. It's simply about aliens who violate our borders, violate our laws, thereby imperiling public health, public safety, national security, and the jobs of Americans.
Mike, that was well said. And I think you raise a point that I want to get at, which is, you know, you remember, of course, under the Obama administration, the DOJ's lawsuit against Arizona for attempting to enforce the immigration law.
Well, they wrote a parallel law that paralleled the federal law. In fact, I worked with a law firm retained by Jan Brewer. I provided them with an extensive deposition that was used as part of their framework for the legal argument when they went to the Supreme Court.
So we find that the state governments aren't allowed to enforce the law, and now we're being told that the federal government won't be allowed to enforce the law either.
Right. So the idea is they want a borderless country, and what they've really created, especially in California, with the open hostility towards the immigration agents and these laws that they've now passed, maybe we should call them no-go states instead of sanctuary states, because they're doing everything they can to throw roadblocks in the path of immigration law enforcement officers. And by the way, coming to the country illegally is a continuing crime. If you run the border, you don't become less illegal by getting further from the border. When police are told that there's a bank robbery, they're not told, don't chase the bank robber if they get out of the bank. You know, because you make your way from the border to some city inside the United States doesn't confer legal status upon you. It's a continuing crime. But imagine
and of course, criminals find all the time that when they break one law, it then becomes necessary to break additional laws. Because, you know, if you're not in the country legally, that's exactly right.
I said this when I went before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I referenced my appearance, by the way, at an article I just wrote for Front Page Magazine. But at that hearing, I said that the policies of the Obama administration had, in essence, fired the starter's pistol for aspiring illegal aliens from around the world who are determined to come here and see the border as simply the finish line to this race for the United States. This simply encourages and emboldens ever more illegal aliens to enter the United States. It puts an increased burden on the Border Patrol, and it puts an increased burden on law enforcement, because among those people are criminals, fugitives, potentially terrorists. I can't imagine any rational thought process behind this other than some twisted political goal that they're trying to achieve.
Well, let's get into that article that you wrote for Front Page Magazine, and I thought it was pretty striking. You talk about the recent change to the mission statement of the Immigration Service. Tell us what the changes were and how it really highlights sort of the Trump administration's view of the immigration problem.
Sure, Kyle. You know, when I testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and this was back in 2013, I took issue with the fact that Doris Meisner, who had been the commissioner for the Immigration Service, had said we needed to be customer-oriented. And I said, well, maybe we should be customer-oriented, but the question that no one seems to be answering is who is the customer, because to Doris Meisner and prior administrations, the customers were illegal aliens. We seem to have forgotten that the customers are really the citizens of the United States. And so I saw that there was a notice put up just a couple of weeks ago where the head of Citizenship and Immigration Services, a division of the Department of Homeland Security that adjudicates 6 million applications every year for citizenship, for political asylum, for the issuance of green cards and so forth, very critical. You know, citizenship represents the keys to the kingdom. And there have been so many failures of that system, because the philosophy has been a get to yes. No matter what happens, approve the application. The customer is always right. So suddenly we have a new director under the leadership of President Trump who says we're going to eliminate that notion of the customer. And so in so doing, what that person said, well, let me just read a little piece of this. What we do at USCIS, that's that agency we're talking about, Citizenship and Immigration Services, is so important to our nation, so meaningful to the applicants and petitioners, and the nature of the work is often so complicated that we should never allow our work to be regarded as a mere production line or even described in business or commercial forms. In particular, referring to applicants and petitioners for immigration benefits and beneficiary for such applications as customers promotes an institutional culture that emphasizes the ultimate satisfaction of the applicants and petitioners. So in other words, let's stop thinking of them as customers. And I have to tell you, I was elated, not so much because maybe they actually listened to me. And sometimes when you sit at those hearings, you feel like you're doing that old cell phone commercial, can you hear me now? But because that's the philosophy that I've always believed should prevail when you're dealing with this important function that really is a matter of national security.
Mike, I think that is a really perfect thing point to end on. So, Mike, we really appreciate all that you've done for this country and also to help us better understand the threats that we face. Thank you very much. Stay tuned here on Secure Freedom Radio for the next segment of the day, which will be an interview that Frank Gaffney had at the recent National Religious Broadcasters Association.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined by a friend of many years, a man I've admired for a long time for his courage and for his willingness to speak truth to power. His name is E. Ray Moore. He is, among other things, an evangelizing man when it comes to our freedoms and what we need to do to safeguard them. His organization is Frontline Ministries, which he describes as having its purpose the Great Commission, and who's responsible for educating your children. Ray, I think that this is such an important topic, and I'm so delighted to have caught up with you here at NRB. I know that you're making the rounds warning about what we're doing to our country by failing to educate our children properly. Particularly, this has been much on my mind. We talked about it a fair amount when we were at CPAC last week. It's weighing on me that we're watching children in our country, of course, at the moment, through the prism of some of them being killed, which is a horror. But we're watching them in schools coming away without, it seems, any appreciation of our Constitution or any particular love for our country, or, as best I can tell, embrace of the values that have made it what it is, the greatest country on the planet Earth. Talk to me about why that is. What's going on in our educational system that's having that kind of horrible result?
Well, it's important for people in our churches, conservative people, traditional people, I'm sure your audience, to understand, first of all, that the public school system has been totally and thoroughly captured by the left and people who do not share our constitutional history or belief in it, Americanism, and our Christian values. So I started this Exodus Mandate Project as a division
of... Before we get to that, let me just drill down on that for a moment.
Okay.
The term that's often used to describe that takeover... Mm-hmm. has been the march through the institutions of the cultural Marxists. Yeah,
that's correct.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, that's
because I wonder, in addition to them, there's another element at work, as I know you're aware. I have come to call this the red-green axis, the red of the hard left and the green of the Islamists. Are they a factor, as you see it, in takeover and corruption
in some of the school systems? I think the San Diego school system recently has approved widespread teaching of Islam in the whole school district, and people are just horrified at it. But we have to realize that we take a position with the Exodus Mandate Project, and that's what we're better known for, Exodus Mandate Project, which is a subdivision of Frontline Ministries. It's getting particularly church children, or the Christian children, out of the government schools into the free and safe sanctuary of private Christian homeschooling. So that's our mission. And we don't believe that the state system can be reformed or ever will be reformed. And sadly, a lot of our conservative and Christian friends are still trying to fix the broken public school system. And we can't do it. I saw recently where there was a large Christian conservative group that met, and they had a whole seminar on teaching people how to run for school board. Well, I never encourage anybody to run for school board. You want to really waste 4 years, even if you could get elected, you wouldn't have a bit of influence. And you can't change the curriculum, the policies, the personnel. And if you were able to be at least bit successful, you'd be facing lawsuits. We've got to set up a whole new model, whole new system.
I've only become really cognizant of the homeschooling program in recent years, and I've been enormously impressed by what I've learned. But for the benefit of our audience, which probably knows more about it than I do, just clarify, what do you mean when you say private Christian homeschooling?
Okay.
Is that different from other kind of homeschooling?
Homeschooling is where it's a family event. Basically, the parents are the teachers. And we have about 2.5 to 2.8 million children being homeschooled now. And probably 80% of them would be committed Christian families, and some others may not be, but they still have traditional values. And it's growing at about 3 to 5% a year. It's really dynamic. And they turn out very, very well. And they don't vote for Bolsheviks or socialists or progressives either. They vote conservative.
And that is because the parents are conservative.
Right.
That they're taking this time and care of their children.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I was talking with you off air about a woman I've come to know and also admire, who's very much in your space on this.
Mm-hmm.
I know a relative newcomer to it compared to you, but Sam Sorbo.
Oh, yes. Yeah, a wonderful family.
Written brilliantly on the subject. And I heard her the other day talking about how we're actually turning over to the state our children for the indoctrination that is essentially weaning out of them the kind of values and even the constitutional grasp that we need, obviously, to maintain our republic.
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about the school boards and the schools and the curricula being essentially beyond repair, Ray, to what extent do we have an ability to essentially ramp up the alternative, given that, you know, increasingly you have families in which both parents, if there are two parents, in fact, both are working.
Yes.
How do they do the kind of training and teaching that
good, very good question. We believe there's a lot of growth. Now, because I look at the primarily the evangelical and Christian church community. And of course, we're not the only ones doing it, but that's my target. I'm a pastor and a retired Army chaplain, and so I target that group primarily. And there are probably 12 to 15 million children that are still in the government schools. I mean, the churches are empty 5 days a week. We've got all kinds of space. We've got families. We just don't have a will. So we primarily push through our ministry argument that we teach that how we educate our children is an obedience to God issue. We don't really have the freedom, if we're responsible parents, to put them in a pagan, godless, and communist situation. That's not being good parent. Not good being good parenting.
And would you say, as some do, that it was, I think, the early 1960s when God and then prayer were taken out of the schools that this began to unravel?
That was a big turning point. I finished high school. I'd hate to put this out on the air so those people know how old I am, but I finished high school in 1961. And we still had chapel once a week and prayer and Bible reading in a homeroom every day.
In a public school.
In a public school. Now, it wasn't a Christian school as we know it today, but there was a level playing field. Christianity was one of the plurals, and we were given equal representation. Today, it's excluded. You can teach Islam in the schools like you can in San Diego.
And they do.
But not Christianity.
Yeah.
So Christian families have no business being there. You know, I hate to have such a hard message, but we've got to wake up parents. They've got responsibilities.
And it really is a national security imperative.
Yeah, right, it is.
Because they will not get the grounding that they need to make informed, thoughtful, patriotic decisions.
I've got a lot of friends, Frank, that are strong believers in the Second Amendment. But if they really believe in the Second Amendment, they would make all those Second Amendment families get their kids out of the public schools. Because none of those children are going to believe in the Second Amendment that their parents and grandparents believed in. I have a friend who says, Ray, I really think what you're doing is good, but we have all these immediate crises that we have to deal with today. And I said, look, Jerry, I said, if you only concern yourself fighting the barbarians at your front door that are breaking in, at some point, the barbarians at your front door will be your children and grandchildren. And that's what we're facing.
Inside the house.
Yeah,
inside
that's what's happening right now.
Ray Moore, we have to leave it at that. I'd love to have you back on, among other things, to talk about both your experiences and your insights as an Army chaplain, because one of the other areas that we're very concerned about, speaking of national security, is the extent to which faith in the military is becoming something of an endangered species.
Yes.
And, that's a subject for another day.
I served 30 years in the reserve and active Army.
Bless you. We appreciate your service, both that in uniform and that you're rendering with your Frontline Ministries.
Exodus Mandate.
Exodus Mandate. Check it out, folks. E. Ray Moore, thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
Appreciate
it's great
so
to
much.
Be with you again. I appreciate your service, too.
Great to have a chance to talk with you.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.